Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
All right, I'll do it again. I'll do it again.
Good morning.
Good morning. And how are you this morning?
I'm well, thank you.
So this morning I'm talking about flow, which is a continuation of a talk I gave the other day on flow. One flows into the other. And a psychologist named Csikszentmihalyi talks a lot about flow. Talks about flow as being the essence of Buddhist practice. And also talks about how everyday Americans and everyday people from all nationalities at times experience flow in their lives. And how those are really peak experiences in people's lives. And that in fact there are five components generally to flow: deep concentration, joy, emotional buoyancy, lack of self-consciousness, and heightened sense of self-mastery. And so we talked about this on Wednesday, and then I also suggested that through Zen practice we can learn to manifest a full flow, which is different than just some kind of flow experience that you have. And I also was starting to suggest when this stream of people flowed by me that if you're going to be successful at anything, you need to concentrate. So the deep concentration is there. And out of the deep concentration, sometimes there is a joy, an emotional buoyancy, and ultimately a sense of self-mastery. So it's kind of an ordinary experience. But actually to have all five of those components present maybe is not so ordinary. And that's why I think Zen practice is so important. And Zen practice is meant to cultivate and manifest those five. That's really what it's about. But it's also important that we not get attached to some idea about flow even. Because then we miss out on the emotional buoyancy part, on the joyful part, and on the lack of self-consciousness part. When I was a young Zen student, not many years ago, very recently, I was with my teacher, and my first teacher, and I drove him down to Tassajara, the monastery that we lived in. I spent a month there, 2 months there, another 2 months. I would drive him back and forth. I got to be his chauffeur, which was wonderful for me. Everybody wants to hang out with a teacher. Maybe not anymore, but in those days. We were all infatuated. So, and I've told this story before. Every time I was going down to the monastery, I wanted to get down there. I'd been in the city. My city mind was just out of control. And I was looking forward to just being down there in peace and quiet. And what did Suzuki Roshi want to do? People will remember this. They didn't want to say it. Yes. He wanted to stop at one of those crummy cafes that were full of people yelling at each other and slamming dishes down, in contrast to Orioki, in contrast to the way we put dishes down. Eating hamburgers, having banana splits. I'm not going to tell the banana split story today. And so, this disturbed my flow. So this is kind of an immature attitude toward flow, right? That flow is something you're going to get. And that if someone messes with you, they disturb your flow. So this flow lacks emotional buoyancy. It really lacks it because it's clinging to getting some commodity, so-called enlightenment, so-called flow, so-called peace of mind. And then it misses the fullness of flow. another type of flow that I talked about on Wednesday that's fine, but it's still not full and not mature, is compassion neutral flow. And actually, Greg suggested that people could do awful things and have compassion neutral flow. I hope that's not the case, because if there's joy and emotional buoyancy, I don't know. I don't think that. I just saw No Country for Old Men. I don't think that guy, whoever the, you know, that psychopath, I don't think he showed much joy and emotional buoyancy. I don't think there was a trace of joy and emotional buoyancy. I think it was just pent up anger. But in any case, real flow includes compassion. It includes compassion. And on Wednesday, I talked about this guy named Bill Mason, who was the jewel thief who went on stealing jewels for like 30 years, and how he could get himself in a zone where he was just completely still, he was completely concentrated. People wouldn't even know he was in the room. And he could steal jewel after jewel, and he seemed to be without self when he was doing it. Now, was there emotional buoyancy? Actually, it seemed to be while he was doing it, there was. There was. So he's a little closer, but where's the compassion? Where's Avalokiteshvara's compassion? Avalokiteshvara, in our tradition, is the best manifestation of flow, because he takes every form, whatever form is needed to help someone, they take, without being self-conscious about it. Well, that's what I talked about on Wednesday. And then to continue that, I'm going to talk now a little bit about one of my favorite Chinese Zen masters, Chao Cho or Joshu. And I'm going to give some examples of flow in his teaching, in his life. I've talked about him before, but I'm giving new examples today. Chao Cho lived from about 780 to 900. He lived to be a pretty old guy. And he's featured in the Gateless Gate and the Blue Cliff Records. So Chao Cho was asked by one of his monks, how should we employ the mind 12 hours a day? Chao Cho said, "You all are used by the 12 hours. I use them." And Emerson says, "Things are in the saddle and ride mankind." So that's the first thing I think we need to pay attention to. First thing now, and first thing after we've been practicing for a while, is do we feel used by our time, by our life? Do we feel like we don't have control, like things are impinging on us? Do we feel like we can't fit in what we want to do, and we're always anxious about something or other? Then, as Emerson says, things are in control and riding us. We're being ridden by those things, by those emotions. So, Chao Cho says, just use the 12 hours. Just use the 12 hours. Instead of be used by them. And how do we do that? Well, how do we do that? We know that when we do things we love, there's close to a sense of flow, isn't there? When you really love something, really love doing something, you really love being with someone, even if you really love just cleaning the zendo. You could really love cleaning the zendo to make it look good so you feel good, so people would enjoy sitting with each other. If you really love it, you're in flow when you're doing it. And then you don't feel used. You don't feel burned out. Oh, shit, I had to do this again. Because you give yourself to it. And secondly, having goals. Having goals that you care about. Our lives are short. Really short. My life seems shorter and shorter all the time. I wonder what's going on here. Having goals that you really care about will also help you be more in flow. And thirdly, just adding a meditative component to your life, or reintroducing it if you've let it go. Because if there's a meditative component to your life, then you don't feel used, because you're you're joined to what you're doing. So another monk asked Joshu. This is all, this whole thing, the rest of the thing I'm going to say, a monk asked Joshu this, yes, this, yes, this. Another monk asked Joshu, what is the word of the ancients? Well, Joshu, now I'm using, now I'm falling back on the Japanese pronunciation, Joshu. So I may go between Chaucho and, I'm trying to do the Chinese pronunciation, which is actually correct, but for 20 years I only knew the Japanese, so, okay. So it's the same guy. So a monk asked Chaucho, what is the word of the ancients? And Chaucho was, like any good Buddhist teacher, he was somewhat of a scholar. I mean, you don't see it when you read the Gateless Gate and the Blue Cliff Records, but they're somewhat scholars, meaning they learned about all the different sutras, they learned about all of their all the different ways of practicing, tips for how to practice. So what is the word of the ancients? What do the ancients have to say from all of this teaching? And of course, and Chaucho says, listen carefully. That's all he says. Listen carefully. So what's the theology of Buddhism? Some people have been in programs where they've had to come up with what their Buddhist theology is lately. What's our theology? Well, there's a lot of theology in the Heart Sutra. There's a lot of theology in the Lotus Sutra, the Eightfold Path, the Five Skandhas, the Three Marks of Existence. A lot of theology, and it's helpful to us. But ultimately, the theology of Zen is really just stop, look, and listen. That's all there is. That's all there is. And I know you don't compete well against Christianity when you say that. But who cares? Who cares? This isn't a competitive deal. It's just what your mother told you when you were trying to cross the street, when you were, or your father when you were 4 years old, 5 years old. Stop, look, and listen. Stop. Really stop. Really look. Really listen. That's our theology. We don't have any theology than that. Go someplace else if you want some other theology. There are lots of theology. Well, actually, come to our Thursday morning study group. But all that theology is meant to help us stop, look, and listen. And when we stop, look, and listen, flow is there already. It doesn't matter the activity. It doesn't matter what you're doing. If you're by the lake and it's 30 by below, if you're on the toilet, if you're not feeling well and you have to stay in bed, it's the same. It's not the same. It's just flow. You don't know the same. You just are. Everything just is. And to do stop, look, and listen, you have to restrain yourself because you're not used to it. Even though your mom told you how to do it when you were four, you only do it for cars because you don't want to get killed. You have to learn to do it for everything if you want to be a Zen practitioner, for everything. Learn to do it. You restrain yourself. You bring yourself back to just this, whatever this activity is. You just bring yourself back to it. And then you relax into that listening, into that feeling, into that looking, into that cleaning the Zendo, if you're cleaning the Zendo. So we have practice period now, as I said, and we're like 2.5 weeks into it, and everybody makes a commitment to do some daily meditation practice. Everybody makes that commitment. And then we have a check-in, and some people are embarrassed to say, well, I only did so many minutes. Some people say, oh, I did so many minutes. And that's cool, but it's all to help us develop habits of stopping, looking, and listening. And if we don't do it on our zafu, we can do it prone in bed. If you don't go to sleep, if you really stop, look, and listen when you're prone, you can do it. There's no place you can't do it. Once when I taught a Jon Kabat-Zinn class years ago, we one of the people in the class had a watch with an hour timer, and their practice was their hour timer was a nice little beep. Was every time that hour time they set it for the whole day, and every time it went off, they stopped, they looked, and they listened, and it helped them. Helped them a lot. So another monk asked Joshua. These are all monks, by the way. You know, the guys did one thing and the women did another. They did the same thing, but the guys were prominent, right? They wrote all the stuff about the guys. The women, except for a few of these tea hut women, were not known, and they did the practice, but they weren't recorded because of Chinese culture and the stratification and the subjectification of women, which is not going to happen in 21st century Zen. I hope. A monk asked Joshu, how can I improve my life through Zen? Well, what's the point of doing Zen if you aren't going to improve your life? I mean, just to have to sit every day and have the same old stuff coming up and not improve your life? How can I improve my life? Through Zen. And Joshu says, it takes quite a time for the gourd to hang over the east wall. That's his answer. It takes quite a time for the gourd to hang over the east wall. Quite a time. Thoreau says, the bud swells imperceptibly without hurry or confusion, as though the short spring days were an eternity. Thoreau knew a little bit about flow, I think, don't you? He knew a little bit about it. He knew a lot about it. So, it takes time. It takes time. Over and over and over. Stop, look, and listen. Over and over and over. Restrain. But don't restrain in a tight way. Just restrain and bring yourself back. That's all. Just bring yourself back and then relax into it. Even if it's achy body, relax into it. That achy body is nothing bad. It's just what is. Just relax into it. Pretty good? Pretty good. So I first met Katagiri Roshi, the head teacher here, in many, many years ago. In 1964. And I remember maybe in 1964 or 1965 he had to give his first talk at San Francisco Zen Center. And he was not in flow. He was really shaky. And he was open about it. He said, God, do I have to do this? Suzuki Roshi told me I had to do this, but he didn't tell me how. He just said, no notes. And I thought, oh, you can have notes. He just meant don't read. He said, oh, that's good. He said, but I can't read. I said, no, I noticed he never reads. We don't read. Because if we don't read, it doesn't come from our heart. Doesn't come from our hearts. We never read. We give talks. Because this is about being in the world, not about something we learned. So I remembered that, how hard it was for him, how he struggled, and then once he'd get into his talk after a while, he would be okay. Then and 20 years later, 18 years later, maybe 16 years later, I went with him to the East Coast when he had been practicing for 16, 18 years since 1964. Then I saw on the East Coast how on the plane and the East Coast, meeting people, preparing his talk, how he just was so kind of just here, just giving himself and laughing and enjoying himself. And it was not the man that I had met in 1964, but 18 years of stopping, looking, and listening. That was the heart of his life, the heart of his life. Zazen every morning, Zazen every night. And then trying to apply it outside the Zendo. because the zento is just the zento, just a room with four walls. So it takes a while for the gourd to fully mature and droop down over the left wall. So Joshu, or Chacho, did not have, was not very well known in his life. He didn't have hardly any Dharma heirs, hardly any successors. His school died out within probably less than a century. But a lot of people wrote stuff down about what he did. So he didn't get well known until he'd been dead for 300 years. That's because during his lifetime, he wasn't into self-promotion. He just wasn't into self-promotion. He only cared about one thing, helping people stop, look, and listen. Helping people wherever he was. That's what he did. He helped people. So this was a time in China, and there are times like this every few centuries, or maybe every century. This was a time in China where the Buddhist leaders were competing, spiritual materialism competing. The Zen teachers, how many students, how much close could they get to the emperor? Everybody wants the emperor's favor, because the emperor is not like George W. Bush. Everybody wants his favor. And everybody wants to have a temple with a more spacious meditation hall and better disciplined monks. But he only cared about that. And so he didn't try to raise a lot of money for his center, because he thought, life is short. This is really what I care about. So his center was kind of run down. And you would think some of the other people, did pick things up, but that was his focus. That was his focus. At this kind of corrupt time in Buddhist history. But Buddhist history is full of corrupt times. Christian history is full of corrupt times. Muslim history is full of corrupt times. Dogen, the founder of this school, lived in a corrupt time of Buddhist history. Such a corrupt time, he had to leave Japan and go to China, because Japanese Buddhism was so corrupt, to try to find a teacher who could really help him learn to stop, look, and listen. Suzuki Roshi wanted to leave Japan for years and years and years. He said, Buddhism in Japan, they don't really do it. It's just all show. That's what he says. He said, it's all show. They look good. They're beautiful. Their robes are beautiful. Their style is beautiful. Zen in the art of this, Zen in the art of that. He said, but where is the Zen? Where is the Zen? Where is the stopping? The looking. And when you look, we really look, is there anything you don't see? Is there anything you don't see? And where is the listening? So he was so happy to get to come to San Francisco, because he thought, maybe there'll be a chance to revive this corrupt Buddhism. Maybe. Just as Jogen thought that in 1200s. Just as Joshu thought that in the 900s. Because as human beings, we're kind of, what are we like? We always fall back on the familiar. We so quickly go from our spiritualism to spiritual materialism, don't we? It's so quick, and we don't even know it. We don't even know it, that we've forgotten the core, the essence, which is just to be in flow. So another monk asked, Joshu, what is the special teaching of your school? What is the special teaching of the Zen school? Joshu said, though the folding screen is broken, the frame is there. Though the folding screen is broken, the frame is there. So, the folding screen, our effort to be present, to be in flow, to be compassionately with our activity with our world, with each other. And we break it. We break the screen. We broke the screen yesterday, the day before, the day before that. We're always breaking the screen. And we get discouraged when we break the screen. But the frame is always there. At any time, any human being can stop, look, and listen. And the reason we do so much zazen is because stopping and looking and listening is so hard for human beings. It's fine for me to say it any time, but most human beings don't even know what that means. They have to have a video in front of them with it, where everybody is killing each other to really stop. Or they have to have some beautiful art exhibit to help them stop. They can't just have this, because we get addicted to that art exhibit or that video. That's a wonderful addiction, but it's the positive addiction. And in flow, there's no addiction. There's just what we're doing. So the frame, you can always come back to the frame of just watching your breath, of just looking out the window, of just whatever it is. Katagiri Roshi calls that devotion to your activity. Very simple, very simple. And in one of the chapters that we are studying in his book, which is titled Time, Place, and Person, it's a short chapter, Time, Place, and Person, he says, if we want to get a taste of Zen, we want to get a taste of flow, and he actually talks quite a bit about flow in these chapters, we need to cultivate the best time. What's the best time to do it? What's a time when you're not all bothered by things, when you can just take a few deep breaths, when you can just eat without talking to anybody and just really be with your food? You need to cultivate those times. You need to fit those times into your life so that you can find the best time. What's the best place? How can you create the best environment in your house so you can just do zazen there, or just be still, even if you're lying on your back, providing you're not sleeping? Sleeping is fine, but you're not going to get a sense of what I'm talking about much through sleeping, I don't think. If you do, then that'll be interesting. You come talk to me about that. You have to cultivate the place. You have to create an aesthetically pleasing enough environment to be able to do this, but not so aesthetically pleasing that it's going to distract you from being here. You have to cultivate the person, you, the person. Well, how can you change your attitude a little bit? How can you deal with all your negative stuff a little bit by putting it aside? Change your attitude. So he says that in the chapter, and then he says, also in the chapter, he says, well, all that's true, but the best time is always now. The best place is always here. The best person is always you, just as you are right now. So both. Joshu is probably known best for his saying, a hair's breadth of difference, and earth and heaven and earth are split apart. A hair's breadth of difference, and heaven and earth are split apart. On the one hand, that's true. That's true. That when we're in flow, there's no split. There's no split. And I've told stories about Suzuki Roshi before, which I will tell again and keep telling until I die. Stories about how, like, when we were moving rocks at Tassajara, at the Zen monastery, and for his rock garden, we were up on a little hill, and he was in his 60s,
We were all in our 20s. He was in his 60s. He fell down when wrestling with a rock, and he just rolled to the bottom of the hill. He got up, brushed himself off, looked at us, and said, "Just like a stone." If that ain't flow, what is? Another time, we were getting ready for a rock and roll concert at the Zen monastery. Well, you know, this is 60s Zen, right? And Suzuki had heard some of that rock and roll from across the street, but he said he told me he much preferred the Shakuhachi. And I said, "Yeah, well, they're not too close, are they?" He said, "No, not at all." But we get to have, it was a 4 or a 9 day, those are days off in the Zen monasteries. Not completely off, because you still get up and sit in the morning. But both basically off. It was a 4 day or a 9 day. So we're going to have I think it was some holiday too. We're going to have a rock and roll party. So I thought to myself, well, I wonder if he's going to go to that rock and roll party. And I walked in the room, and there was this little old man. You know, he was about 4'10". And there was, the music was playing, and there was sort of a light show going on, only he was making the light show. Because he had this, like this cookie, what do you call it, cookie, pardon?
Cookie sheet.
Yeah, cookie sheet. And he was dancing around and making all kinds of lights with a cookie sheet. He was the light show, basically. Not exactly like the Shakuhachi. But what's the difference? What's the difference? In our minds, we think there's a difference, because we always want to go toward flow. But flow is always here. It's always here. Everything is moving, isn't it? Can you deny that? Everything is moving already? You can resist it all you want. You will. You will, because you are pretty determined human beings. Well, there you go. A monk asked Joshu. I won't go on too long, you guys. When I get into this stuff, oh, that's great. Oh, this is great. A monk asked Joshu, "When the entire body crumbles, scatters, there is one thing, eternal, spiritual. Is that not so?" What do we say? Buddha nature, big mind, great peace. And Joshu looks out the window and says, "The wind is rising again this morning." The wind is rising again this morning. So that's Joshu's theology. That's the real theology of Zen. There's lots of other stuff we can study, but that's the theology. When Joshu was young, he asked his teacher, Nanchuan, "Where does he go who knows what is what?" Nanchuan said, "He becomes the ox supporting the temple on the hill." So Joshu himself was very much like that. He was the ox supporting the monks on the hill. That's why he didn't get known in his lifetime, because that was not his interest. His interest was to support people and helping them have a little bit of joy in their lives, have a little bit of composure, a little bit of emotional resiliency, which comes from this practice, this very simple ancient practice that I've been talking about, which you can do on a cushion, but you can do anywhere. You can do it anywhere. And so Joshu didn't really have any Dharma heirs, any successors to speak of, and his lineage died out. Maybe that's kind of sad, but he transmitted something. He helped someone, helped people, and then 300 years later they discovered his stuff, and now he's a great hero. Oh, well, so it's all the same, isn't it? So I think that's enough.
Comments? Questions?
When you first used the word, and I think I've heard you use it before, but still it doesn't sound to me automatically mean something.
Oh.
I mean, even though you gave like the five sort
of right.
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 It doesn't sort of automatically ring a bell to me as what you're...
Okay. Well, if you're totally immersed in some activity, and each of us has had that experience at times in our life where we're totally immersed in something. That's simply what flow means. Total devotion, total immersion to an activity. Which includes generally then concentration, some feeling of joy, joyful connectedness, some feeling of emotional resiliency, because at least while you're in it, you can deal with negative emotions. They don't bother you. And some lack of self-consciousness. And then how do you pronounce this guy's name? Csikszentmihalyi's last one is self-mastery. Well, self-mastery is fine, but I actually think in mature flow, there's no sense of self-mastery. Why do you need that? Yeah. Yeah. Well, Katagiri Roshi uses it too in his book when he talks about in the part of the book we're talking about where he talks about skiing, working at the computer. He talks about other things about and of course Suzuki Roshi, when he was asked what's the most important thing in Zen, he said, everything is changing. Well, that's flow. That's flow. But usually we're resisting it. Usually it's interfering with our agenda. However, if we do this, if we practice, I think less and less that's the case. Does that make sense? Oh, yeah.
And it sounded like a little bit like you were using it like it was familiar. And it wouldn't automatically...
Oh, that's a good point. That's a good point. Yeah. Uh-huh. I mean, from the, we get into sort of Buddhist theology. There are no things. There are no objects. There are no human beings. There is just this movement, which we don't even call a movement. And we project our things, our objects, our divisions, based on our words, on this continual kaleidoscope of life and death, which is flow. Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
So we're not just talking about this flow that we're in, and not just the condition. I mean, we're also talking about like the condition.
That's right, but through the concentration of, I think I get what you're saying, but I'm not sure. Okay, so here's a condition. I don't know why I've got cleaning on the zendo on my mind, but here's this zendo, and we're cleaning it, and if we're really concentrating on cleaning it. Really giving ourselves to it. We're not stuck in before and after, or else I'd be somewhere else. We're really enjoying it, really into it. And there's no self-consciousness. There's a sense of joy about, look at the color of this floor. Will I do this? Wow. Look at how my body feels. You know how the Japanese, when I race across the floor, because I can't do that anymore, but you know how they used to. But I can go more slowly and still enjoy it. And at the same time, so that's my flow, but that's also supporting the universe. Because right. Yeah, it's all one flow. So the little flow and the big flow are not two. If the little flow and the big flow are two, then there's this whole thing about turning flow into a commodity. into, you know, I'm going to do this. And that's more partial flow, which is okay too, but it's not very mature. Those are good questions. Anybody else? Other people? Hi.
You talked about how, in the case of the diamond thief, how you felt like he didn't serve other people. And therefore, obviously, didn't exhibit a proper flow in his life. Is that kind of safe to say?
Well, yeah. If you read this story about this guy, Bill Mason, I don't know if you did the book about it. It's a great book. It's a great book. You can see that he, in his interpersonal relationships, he was not that great. I mean, he was very dependent on being a jewel thief to feel good about himself, and he didn't really know how to carry that flow into his big life, because it was a narrower kind of flow. It was just focused on trying to get these jewels. Does that clarify?
Yeah, a little bit.
Uh-huh.
My question off of that is just, is there any cases where actions such as stealing could be considered a right thing to do because it does serve people or serves the greater good ultimately?
Oh, I think so. Sure, I think so. I think you have to be careful about that, because we so easily get into rationalization and self-justification. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think so.
So
sure.
that being the case, would it be safe to say that there's no solid moral standards at all, but it's more dependent on whether or not you're serving other people, that all morals are dependent on that?
Well, that sounds pretty good. I like that. I like that. Yeah. Okay. But let's not take it too seriously.
just try to work.
Pretty good. Yeah.
I was wondering if you could speak a little more about neutral compassion. I didn't use that term.
Oh, I didn't mean to. I meant neutral flow, in which compassion is not is absent. That's all. This Bill Mason is a good example. If compassion, you know what compassion means etymologically, it means passion with, calm with. So we feel passionately about things all the time. Bill Mason felt passionately about stealing jewels. And he was able to do that. He was able to focus, be in his little flow. He didn't have the calm. The calm passion is big. It's sense, because you stopped. And when you stop, and you really look and you listen, your empathy is natural. You don't have to go get trained to be empathic. It's just there.
How though does that relate to joy? I mean, don't you have to have a certain amount of compassion with joy?
Joy and compassion. Well, I think that spontaneous joy usually carries an element of compassion. But it depends on how deep the joy is. I mean, you know, maybe Bill Mason's joy was a little more superficial. It was just the joy of going through this great drama and getting these jewels. Well, that's joy too. Kind of. It depends on how you define joy, right? In Buddhism, we say joy is sukha, S-U-K-K-H-A. But then we don't mean Bill Mason's kind of joy. We mean the joy of really being in compassionate flow. That's what we mean. But don't take that too seriously either. Yes, did I say neutral compassion? I didn't mean neutral compassion. Yeah. Excuse me. Thank you for clarifying. I'm going to have you hang out with me more often. Or ask you to. Yes.
The business of now?
Yeah, the business of the moment, okay.
You know, the industrial complex at the present moment and getting more of this stuff. The business of it, the thoughts around it. It just occurred to me that it could well be that hair's breadth between the future and the past.
In a way, flow doesn't have now in it. That's right. Now is something extra. But now is an important technique to help us. We need that to help us as a because if we don't have that, we just get lost. But that's why Dogen actually says, at one point he says, it's a fallacy to say that everything is changing. Because there's no thing in the first place. So why say everything is changing? Right?
I just had a comment on the joy thing.
Uh-huh.
My understanding is that super means empathetic joy.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Which explains it much more.
Good for you. Yeah. Thank you. That's helpful. Yeah, Phoebe.
our talk reminded me of, I heard someone talk about an interview with the Dalai Lama not too long ago, and someone asked, what was his happiest or most joyful moment, or time in his life?
Uh-huh.
And without hesitation, he just said, well, right now.
Mm.
Because there really, you know, because there isn't any other moment.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And enjoy your nows, which are not even nows.